Hey there, this is your old buddy Tom, the Toonami Operations Module. Settle in, it's about to get good. Toonami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Whenever you're ready.
Welcome to the televised revolution, as we drift through outer space aboard the Absolution. With Tom back in active duty as captain, in charge of bringing superior anime action. Yeah, you came to the right place if you have a taste for animation in deep space base. Broadcast through your television due to the progress of the Bring Back Toonami Twitter mission. The same block that brought us Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z is back, so stay tuned. I remember way back, never leaving my room. I stayed glued to my TV weekday afternoons. Yeah, and thanks to Adult Swim, I have a reason to use the TV in my room again. Cause every night I'll be tuning in, since they going back to showing action tunes again. Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Yeah, Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Welcome to the Anime Action Fan Sanctuary, with Tom providing that slick commentary.
Hey there, my Toonami fans, and welcome to a brand new episode of Tom's Prerogative right here on the Absolution Network. I am, of course, your Prom Tom host, Thomas Prom Tom Mattis, and this is episode 56 of the show. On this episode, we close out Superhero Monk by covering the animated movie, who covers a character who will be coming out in a live-action movie this week. I am, of course, talking about the legendary Marvel character Iron Man, as Iron Man 3 hits theaters this week, and I've seen a lot of different reviews about it. I find it interesting that apparently it's directed by, I guess, one of the people involved with Lethal Weapon. But with all that being said, but of course I'm talking about the direct-to-DVD animated movie, The Invincible Iron Man, which covers Tony Stark's origin, along with saving the world from the evil Mandarin. Though we'll get more into plot synopsis in a little bit. This is going to be a very interesting movie. You know, I'm probably going to spoil the surprise right here. Kind of didn't care for this movie. This is going to be one of those rare sort of reviews where I'm somewhat negative about most of the content. I think the key word that is going to be said out loud for a lot of the review tonight is going to be the word passion. You're going to hear me use that word a lot. Calm down. And it's not that I don't think people didn't have passion wanting to make a good movie, but as far as something missing, I think it is what you're going to hear me be talking about. Another thing that really comes to mind when I watch this movie, or at least after I watch this movie and gave the thought process into it, was it really just perfectly exemplifies sort of different directions in the entertainment market that DC and Marvel are going in. You know, there really is that joke that's been out there, you know, DC can only really be faithful to the characters when they put them in an animated property, but Marvel can only do it when they're in live action. And I think this movie perfectly showcases, and more importantly, in watching sort of Superhero Month and watching movies from DC, how even watching the old Fleischer Superman cartoons, and then watching this movie, the two reasons why that is. And we'll be talking about it later, but it's basically how the universe is set up, you know, DC being a more of a legacy-based universe, Marvel being a more modern mythology-based universe, and I'll explain what I mean by that later, and of course their approach to animation, in general, that is. But, you know, all that's deep in the review. It's going to be an interesting review nonetheless, because like, I don't see this as just a god-awful movie, but you know, when I get into it, you're going to see what I mean about my issues with this movie. We have no emails or comments to talk about, so let's get right into it. With our plot synopsis, the invincible Iron Man begins in China, where while attempting to unearth an ancient Chinese city using his company resources, while also diverting money into a project that will put Stark Enterprises on the cutting edge of technology, Tony Stark's ambitions are thwarted when the Jade Dragons terrorist group attacks the excavation site, killing almost everyone and kidnapping his friend James Rhodey Rhodes. Traveling to the site to investigate, Tony is captured and injured by the Jade Dragons, his life saved by a Chinese shaman and Rhodes' skills as an army medic after a piece of shrapnel damages his heart. The shaman tells Tony that the dragons seek to prevent the return of the Mandarin, an ancient ruler of great power who ruled China 3,000 years ago and who the city commemorates. Should four rings created by the Mandarin, their purpose being granted him power over death, be brought together after the city arises, the Mandarin will awake. The dragons force Tony to construct within a week a weapon to sink the city or he will face execution. To show that they're serious, they kill the shaman. Befriending Lei Mei, a member of the group, Tony learns that she has a duty that has been passed down to her family from father to son. She has no brothers, but she will not reveal what it is. Meanwhile, four elemental spirits are released when the city is raised, and they find two of the Mandarin's rings. Four rings, I should say. When the weapon that Stark and Rhodes create is revealed to be a fake, the dragon's leader is about to shoot Rhodes, but Lei Mei shoots the leader from behind. Tony subsequently emerges in their true project, a suit of armor, rescuing Rhodes. Tony flees the temple and returns home, but Lei Mei refuses his offer to take her with him. Studying a painting of the prophecy, Lei Mei realizes that Tony is the Iron Knight, who it was foretold would battle the Mandarin. But this brings her no comfort, as the prophecy only states that one of the two shall die without specifying who. To spare Tony this fate, she leads the Jade Dragons in an attempt to destroy the city, but the rest of the dragons are killed and she is confronted by a shadowy dragon-like creature. After returning to America, Tony and Rhodes are shocked to discover that they are wanted by S.H.I.E.L.D. for selling weapons to the Jade Dragons. Howard Stark, Tony's father, sent Rhodes weapons to provide enhanced security for the site against Tony's wishes, and with the dragons having stolen the shipment, he has apparently used Tony as a scapegoat to maintain his position. Having escaped S.H.I.E.L.D. agents and sneaking to his office with the aid of his secretary, Virginia Pepper Potts, Tony reveals his side project of Rhodes, multiple suits of armor, each one designed for the task that human beings could not possibly accomplish alone. Taking an underwater suit of armor to the third temple at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, the temple's location provided on a map from the shaman, Tony manages to defeat the fire element by throwing it into the water, but the other three escape with the ring. Following a brief confrontation with his father over Howard framing Tony for the arms dealing, during which it's revealed that the two men have long been at odds over their opinion regarding weapons, a division that's only worsened since the death of Tony's mother, Tony dons another armor and flies to recover the last ring located in an active volcano. Pepper and Rhodes allowing themselves to be arrested to buy Tony time. Although he defeats the air and water elements, he tricks the water element into freezing the air element before throwing the water element into the molten lava and escapes with the ring. Tony's armor is badly damaged by the earth element's assault, forcing him to abandon the armor and make his way home. Having returned to New York, Tony is confronted by Lei Mei, who begs him to give her the ring to prevent the earth element from attacking Tony. Deciding to try and destroy the temple, but unable to reach his more advanced armors due to S.H.I.E.L.D.'s personnel in the building, Tony and Lei Mei return to China using the armor Tony developed while being held prisoner, which remains on the plane he and Rhodes used to return home. Yes, this is a long synopsis. It should explain my issues with this movie. Arriving at the city just as the Earth Elemental rises an army from the ground, Tony clashes with the Elemental, destroying his adversary in a final desperate mid-air collision. However, as he prepares to search for the last ring, Lei Mei reveals that her bracelet is the final ring. Her family seeks to ensue the resurrection of the Mandarin rather than his defeat, and as the last descendant of the Mandarin, only Lei Mei can hold the Mandarin spirit. And only she can become the vessel he needs to walk the Earth again. Admitting that she was the one who gave S.H.I.E.L.D. the documents to incriminate Tony for the arms dealing in an attempt to protect him, Lei Mei begs Tony to leave while he still can, but when he refuses, the army activates, forcing Tony to fight soldiers as Lei Mei advances towards the Mandarin tomb. Although Tony vanquishes the soldier, he is subsequently forced to fight a vast dragon as Lei Mei makes contact with the Mandarin spirit. Despite his damaged armor, Tony manages to defeat the dragon by forcing a vat of liquid metal to expand and solidify inside of it, but when he enters the temple, he finds Lei Mei under the control of the Mandarin. As his armor is torn even further apart by the assault, Tony begs Lei Mei to remember who she is, managing to convince Lei Mei to turn against the Mandarin. As she removes the rings from her hand, the Mandarin's connection to the real world is broken, triggering a brief explosion before his spirit vanishes. But with the last of his breath, he unleashes an energy which blasts Lei Mei. After thanking Tony for saving her with a kiss, Lei Mei dies in his arms, leaving Tony alone in a temple to mourn her death. Returning to the U.S., Tony is cleared of all charges by the Chinese government and S.H.I.E.L.D. and subsequently buys up all available shares in Stark Enterprises, bringing the company under his complete control. However, he only has two actions to take, promoting Rhodes to position of Chief Engineer for Advanced Technology and handling the control of his company over to his father, saying that he always regarded the company as a father-son enterprise. Howard and Tony shake hands, Howard subsequently firing the board of directors to free him and Tony from the bureaucracy that nearly tore them apart. This, after a very, very long plot synopsis, is the invincible Iron Man. Welcome back, and you may have noticed I wasn't exactly playing music that was from the movie. That being that I couldn't find any music from this movie. so I had to go with the next best thing, which is music that was played during an Iron Man film, in this case, AC/DC. Trust me, folks, that's about as exciting as music could possibly get in regards to being connected with this film. You know, speaking of music, let's go over music as we usually do first. it's very interesting because it's okay. You know, the main theme is okay. I think one of the hardest things in doing this review is, again, my only comparison movie-wise really is the Iron Man live-action movies. And here is a more of a traditional score. Not that there isn't a traditional score in Iron Man, or especially the live-action movies, but there's definitely more of a blend with sort of the rock tracks that are in there. This is just a complete traditional score here. And you know, the main theme is okay. Most of the music is just average. There's nothing bad about it. But it's very par for the course in which scene it is. You know, the Chinese music having a bit of a Chinese flair to it. You know, the music having flares to whichever scene it's regarded to and what it's trying to help enhance. But it usually it just feels like it's something in the background. At the end of the day, I think the biggest flaw of the music in this movie is it's just, it's missing passion. You know, when I listen to the music in this movie, I just don't feel the passion from the music that could possibly help enhance the scenes here. And again, I told you we were going to be talking that word a lot and using that word a lot, and it's no more evident here. Whether it be the main theme or the music throughout the series, it's interesting, but it just is missing passion. There's just absolutely no passion I feel from the music in this movie. And because of that, it just feels completely average and par for the course. With that, let's move on to animation. And with the overall art, it definitely felt weird, to say the least. It didn't feel like any connection necessarily to the comic. It felt this very sort of weird. It was very early Marvel direct-to-DVD animation. We sort of saw the same animation in, Doctor Strange. But it just seemed very plain, very middle of the road as far as the overall art, through and through. With the exception of maybe the couple of things that were taken from different comic ideas. But again, that word passion, part of what makes it plain is just I didn't feel any passion throughout the art. The colors and backgrounds and everything were very, very subdued. You could tell very much that they were on a budget. And then, for the most part, telling they were going with different than usual studios. And what I mean by that is, you know, you can tell, you know, DC uses those Japanese studios and the very, probably best Korean animation studios. But this felt like maybe the lower end of sort of Korean, sort of European animation studios definitely in there. And an overall style that sort of borders on what would have been used for television animation at the time. Somewhat comparing it to maybe, what's the show? I'm blanking on the show. Totally Spies. And I felt Totally Spies animation was much better than this animation. Again, most of it is just, overall, I felt like the animation was lacking the passion. And again, let's move on to character designs. Character designs all around were fine. Rhodey and Peppers, I didn't care for, but that, again, it just, with Rhodey and Peppers, it was a matter of, they captured, I guess, the color scheme. You know, there really wasn't any different design-wise, but again, it's more toward how their characters were used. But you know, Tony was fine, you know. I thought he was Tony Stark. But even with Tony's design, just missing that flair, that passion, that thing that, you know, Robert Downey Jr. is able to bring to the role on screen. That's just missing here within the animation. And again, it's not just the actor that brings alive a character in animation. It's also, you know, the animator who, through the drawings that he puts on the screen, you know, because he's... the acting job of for animation is a two-pronged job. Yes, you have the voice being provided by the actor, and he has to sort of portray movement and all of that into the character with his voice, but he also needs a great animator to sort of portray that action and give him the action to sort of project off of. And again, that passion, that flair just missing there, and just it did seem very television-like, I think is one way I could describe the character designs here and the way the character designs moved. Just very plain, lacking passion. Lei Mi was okay, you know, considering she was sort of the main female protagonist, antagonist, many different things. Howard Stark was okay. I mean, through and through, the character designs were... there's nothing wrong with the designs. And I think that's where I'm struggling here. Is that there's just nothing wrong with it. But again, it's that lack of passion that, you know, it definitely feels like this is something that could be on television rather than this is a movie. The action sequences were very uninteresting. Because again, this is going to go into special effects as well, because of the special effects work. You know, usually I tag special effects with the backgrounds, but I think I need to tag it with the action, because, you know, while the action was hand-drawn, it was very obvious, especially the special effects in the action sequences, and that, you know, the spirits and everything were CG. Sort of cel-shaded animated. And it was it just stood out as a different style than the rest of the stuff that was on film. And it's one of those things that not only is it lacking passion, but it takes you completely out of sort of the fantasy that you're in. So I found that very distracting in the movie. The special, outside of sort of the CG special effects, again, very plain to the road. I think the best thing art-wise of this movie is the backgrounds. I think the locations they chose, like the underwater temple and everything, they're extremely well done, very unique backgrounds. But as good as they are, it's not something I'm going to like, hey, I need to get a frame of this screenshot of this background. But with that being said, I think the things I like the use of water around. This is where the subdued aspect of the film really works. That the sort of very subdued watercolor aspect of the backgrounds, I thought are done very, very well. Yeah. Well, with that, we're going to take a very quick break. Play a couple of promos, and when we come back, we're going to get into acting and into story.
ChefPlus.com.
Okay, let's get this show on the road, gang.
I'm Batman.
Second job for Superman.
Monthly Mondays, available the third Monday of every month at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com.
In the decade of the 1930s, even the great city of Cleveland, Ohio, was not spared the ravages of the Great Depression. In a time of fear and confusion, a character emerged that would entertain and inspire millions of children and adults alike. He began not as flesh and blood, but as a simple line drawing. His comic book adventures thrilled millions around the world. The magic of radio gave to his name a breathless signature and sound. Then with television came a whole new generation to idolize his exploits. In the 70s, the world believed a man could fly. In the 80s, he was reborn in the comics. And the 90s saw his death, rebirth, and marriage. In the 21st century, he returned to the big screen and saw his origin changed and retold on several occasions. Through the decades, he has gone by many names. The Man of Tomorrow. The Last Son of Krypton. The Man of Steel. His strength is incredible. His name is legendary. His battle is never ending. Faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound.
My name is Michael Bailey, and I host an internet radio show called Views from the Long Box. Superman is my favorite character of all time, and in 2013, he is turning 75. Because of this, a large portion of the episodes this year will be about the Man of Steel in a series I'm calling
Superman at 75, the celebration of a legend.
I'm going to mark Superman's birthday in fine style by examining all aspects of the character's history, from the comics, to the movies, to the television series, and beyond, both alone and with the best and brightest of the podcasting world. It may not be every episode, but the bulk of Views in 2013 will be all about the Man of Steel. He is the first and greatest superhero of them all, and he deserves no less.
Superman at 75. The celebration of a legend.
A series within a series, and the biggest birthday card a fan can give his favorite hero, only at Views from the Long Box. Views from the Long Box is a Fortress of Baileytude production. New episodes drop every other Tuesday over at www.viewsfromthelongbox.com, and for this series, over at www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
And welcome back, and let's get right into it with acting. First, let's go over that cast list. Mark Warden is Tony Stark slash Iron Man. Of course, Mark would voice Iron Man and a couple other Marvel direct-to-DVD movies. Gwendolyn Yao as Lei Mei. Elijah Gabarelli as Virginia Pepper Potts, and yeah, I have her in front of the other characters because I initially thought she would be a bigger character. Turns out I was wrong. But Fred Tuskorsky as Mandarin. Rodney Salisbury as Jim Rhodey Rhodes. And John McCook as Howard Stark. I guess we'll start with the protagonist here. Of course, the main one, too. Mark Warden. He does a very decent job as Iron Man and Tony Stark. He has that bit of a playboy feel, but he's missing that overall flair that Rodney Downey Jr. brings to Iron Man the live action. And again, I think it is completely unfair for me to compare his voice work for Iron Man to Robert, because Robert Downey Jr. is just perfect to play Iron Man. I think everybody has realized that now. There is no more of a perfect sort of actor and voice for Iron Man than Robert Downey Jr. But even so, there's a sense of flair that you need to have to sort of perform Tony Stark. And I think that's missing here. I'm trying to remember who voiced him in Earth's Mightiest Avengers as I try to bring up and try to remember which one that is. But the guy who did it in Earth's Mightiest Avengers did a much better job at it than Mark Wooden did. And Eric Loomis, he was able to capture that flair. And yes, I was going through my notes looking for my notes because I actually keep all my notes on my podcast. But Eric Loomis had that great flair and a sense of, yeah, that feels like Tony Stark. There's a uniqueness there that really was captured. Mark Warden really didn't capture that. At times, he felt very plain, and it's that overall passion. Again, it's not that he did necessarily a bad job, but that passion that really hurts, connecting to his performance. Rodney Salisbury, he did a great job with what he had to work with, and I think his character was overall screwed by sort of story and, animation. But for what he had to work with, he did a great job of sort of playing off the more subdued factor that Mark Wooden was playing Tony Stark as. And then Eliza Gabrielli, I don't think she necessarily did a bad job. I just don't like this idea of Pepper Potts as British. And now, again, this could be something to where they were taking this completely from the Ultimate Iron Man universe. I really don't have as much. My Iron Man knowledge is very sketchy. It's mostly what I've learned here or there and sort of in talks of comics, but it's mostly 616. I really have no knowledge of the Ultimate universe. But again, other shows like Earth's Mightiest Avengers, which have been also somewhat based off the Ultimate Universe, Pepper's in there is American. To my knowledge, Pepper has always been American. So for her to be, and not just British, but this very old British lady secretary, just didn't seem right to me. And I just don't think that was the right voice to go with for Pepper. From there, we'll go on to the antagonists. Gwendolyn Yao, I think, had probably the best performance in this movie. You really felt for her character in a lot of places. She did a great job of actually breathing some passion into the character to make you feel for the character. One of the few spots where passion was there. Unfortunately, not all the time with her character. I think probably one of the best scenes was the scene to where, and it kind of foreshadowed it, and once everything that goes down at the end of the movie goes down, and you look back at it, it really foreshadows how that was foreshadowing, but obviously failed. But, the point to where, she's come to that realization that she can escape her fate And she just sort of breaks down and cries and begs for forgiveness from the Mandarin spirit when all the dragons are killed. That was a really emotional scene and just really well done. Again, it's an example of sort of the passion she did bring to the role. One of the few aspects where passion was in the movie. Fred Tuskorsky really had only a small part as the Mandarin, because you only heard the voices here or there. It's okay, and it, you know, honestly, at the end, sort of coinciding with Gwendolyn Yao's voice as it did, it was very deafening, very threatening. So in that sense, I think he accomplished what he needed with the Mandarin. Unfortunately, I don't think he would just give him much to work with the Mandarin, as the Mandarin's character was more spirit than real. And then you have Howard Stark, and it's... I guess I have an antagonist, because he is somewhat of an antagonist in this film towards Tony. McCook did a great job of sort of capturing a very sort of hard-nosed father feel to the character that one thinks of with Howard Stark. Again, I think it's... more of an example, not as much as, you know, with Fred Tchaikovsky, but again, he's really this sort of background character. He does have some great moments with Mark Warden as Tony Stark, particularly the moment where they're sort of talking about the mother and talking about sort of why they're angered against each other. That's actually one of the better moments for Mark Warden in this movie as well. So, at the end of the day, voice acting, I think, is okay. Again, some of that passion is missing from some of the characters. Some of it's, you know, just the wrong idea for the voice. But there is some good acting, and this is for some very good moments as far as acting-wise from the voice actors. With that, let's move on to story, which is the big thing with this movie, because it's really where it sort of falls apart. The overall plot and theme of this movie kind of feels weird because it feels too complicated. I think maybe I sort of showcased that by reading that whole giant synopsis at the beginning of the review. That, you know, I think I started at 4 minutes. It took me to 11 minutes, so it was like, what, a 7 minute reading of the plot synopsis, because you have all these different things going on, and there's really no theme to it. And I think that's the thing that, to me, hurts it more, is that I would be okay with it if there was this overall theme to it, but there really isn't. There isn't. I mean, you have the sort of the dragon plot going on with LeMay, and that Tony Stark is the Iron Knight to face the Mandarin at the same point in time. The whole thing that's going on with, as I hit my tower fan, possibly breaking my hand. Not really, but I'm a horrible actor, folks. You know, what I should have done is go, oh, my head! Oh, my God! Somebody say... I'm going to get back on track now. But the whole thing with, you know, the sort of the board trying to get rid of Tony trying to make the business money, and the whole betrayal, and, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. complicating factors even more. You know, S.H.I.E.L.D. just seemed like a tool in the entire movie to be there for roadblocks, be there in the story. There's a lot of complications to the plot. And a lot of things going on, and it never feels like one aspect of those plots feel... Well, I'll take that back. It does feel like the more Mandarin and the Iron... You know, Tony Stark being Iron Man to stop the Mandarin aspect of the plot is a bit stronger than the sort of whole business takeover aspect. But there's just really no direction and sort of no passion in the direction towards either in the plot. Another thing is, as we go into point two, there's definitely aspects where this is a definitely more adventure-based story, more magic-based, as opposed to a more of an action sort of superhero aspect that is very typical with sort of Iron Man himself. I don't think it works here. There's a lot of mysticism that just leave me scratching my head. And again, the passion isn't there to really make it work, I think. I think the aspect of when I look at it from more of an action standpoint is there is that great scene to where Tony reveals the suits to Rhodey, and you see all these different suits. And they play the suits off less like sort of a suit of armor. You know, again, that whole aspect of Tony becoming Iron Man that's been played in television series and in the movies has been the idea that, you know, he's creating his suit. It helps him live, but it's also something that allows him to sort of right injustices that he felt he's been responsible for. You know, essentially somebody who builds weapons to stop weapons. But here, the suits are definitely played from a more adventure aspect of that. Oh, here's all these suits. You know, this program that I've been building to build suits help humans go to places where they couldn't normally go. And missing is the whole aspect of it, you know, helping his heart survive. You know, in that aspect, there's a lot of passion, a lot of sort of great storytelling aspect that's core to, I think, Tony Stark that's missing there. By playing in more of an adventure, more magic-based attitude to the series. I think third point I'll talk about here is definitely the more movement to the mixture of both sort of 616 and Ultimate Universe. I don't know as much as I wish I did, but it definitely seems they went all over the place with the comic, doing a lot of different things. You know, one, Howard Stark being alive. I don't really remember that in the original comic. I've actually gone back and read the actual, again, they were in trade paperback and in collection form, but I've gone back and read the actual first adventures of Tony Stark, and I remember his father being dead at the beginning of there, so that was something that was really different, really a drastic difference that you felt from Iron Man, or at least from the Iron Man story that you would know of. Again, Pepper being British didn't make sense unless that was from the Ultimate Universe. The big thing from the Ultimate Universe I noticed was, when they showed off the suits, a couple of them were, you know, that last one they showed was the Ultimate Iron Man suit. So they, and to an extent, that's sort of a cool little fan service scene to where, like, they have all these different sort of Iron Man suits from around the years, and that Tony's built these. But definitely, it's something to where it just feels different. And moving on to the last point, and if it seems like I've sort of flew through this review, and again, I found the perfect word to describe all my issues with it. It is passion. But one thing I think this movie perfectly highlights is the difference between sort of DC and Marvel in these cases. I talked earlier in the review that it's sort of a showcase differences of the sort of the way the universes are. You know, DC is more of a legacy-based universe, whereas Marvel is more of a sort of modern mythology universe. And allow me to explain what I mean. You know, when you look at sort of the origin stories of DC, what are they? Look at Superman's. He's the last son of a planet that died and exploded, who was sent to Earth where he was found by Jonathan and Martha Kent, who taught him sort of core American values of truth, justice, and the American way. There's sort of a legacy to that origin that can't be sort of redone. There, what of that sort of origin that can really be, there are certain points maybe you can tweak here or there, but for the most part, every time the origin's been told, it's been the same. Again, look at Batman. What is his origin? His origin is that his parents were gunned down before him coming home from the movies by a sort of crook who just wanted their money, which ultimately drove him to in a sense, seek revenge and, you know, seek revenge for his mother and father's death, ultimately becoming Batman to stop crime in the city of Gotham. You know, you could tweak bits and pieces there. You know, for instance, like in the Dark Knight trilogy by, Christopher Nolan. I blanked on his name for a second. But, you know, instead of having them go see a Zorro movie, he had them see opera. But again, it's just a small little tweak. The core aspect of everything that happened there still happens in the origin. Again, it's a origin that pretty much has stayed the same throughout the years. Let's go to a lesser known DC characters like The Flash, and in this case, I'll go with Barry Allen. You know, while sort of working in his lab, a freak lightning bolt strikes the lab and gives him super speed. You know, there's a core aspect to that origin that has stayed the same over the years. Look at Green Lantern. A test pilot finds a crashed spaceship, and a ring that emerges from the spaceship chooses him and makes him part of the Green Lantern core. Again, throughout the years, that core origin has stayed the same. Because the way those origins have been built for these DC characters, to an extent, you can maybe tweak a thing here or there, a small little thing here or there, but the real basic stuff stays the same. You know, there's a core stay to the origin there. Now let's look at Marvel. You know, Marvel's origins, while there's a much smaller core sense to it, have to evolve with the time because of how they were built. You know, essentially, for instance, with Spider-Man, he is a character who is basically bitten by a spider to give some spider powers. But the core idea of how he gets those spider powers have changed over the years. From it being a radioactive spider to it being a genetically altered spider. And again, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it showcases sort of the difference here between the companies. Because, for the most part, again, most of the origin stories within Marvel are very much like that. And a perfect example here, you know, I mentioned before how, again, in the movie, it's sort of told, or the live-action movie, is told that the suit helps, you know, keep him living. Because it part of, you know, with the whole arc reactor that's in his body and everything. This movie totally does away with it. They really never go into what the thing in his chest is. But, you know, instead of the suits being something that, you know, he creates to sort of help him, you know, because of his situation, you know, he had created the suits long before and they're there for exploration. The core aspect of sort of the origin of the suit and everything is very different from what we know of Tony Stark. So right there, you see that you have these core differences being shown here between DC and Marvel. Now, why do I necessarily bring this up? Well, in this case, we're talking about why Marvel doesn't do well in animation and why DC does. Well, the aspect is, again, the universe. I think sort of the legacy aspect of the universe works so much better, or at least DC has been able to make the legacy aspect work a whole lot better in animation form. And part of that has become because at the end of the day, DC fully embraces animation as a great way to tell the legacy stories. Marvel has really never, I think, for the most part, really embraced animation as a way to tell their stories, because their stories have always been evolving, you know, because of how modern times evolve. And again, a lot of times I'll be trying to play the animation off as laughs instead of taking it seriously. You know, and if you need any more examples of this, look at the fact that, you know, probably the... And they say that they plan to end Earth's Mightiest Avenger there. I kind of don't believe it. But look at Spectacular Spider-Man. You know, it... Probably the best Marvel animation has ever done. Done by Sony Studios, and as I found out recently, done by the same people who did Godzilla the Animated Series. But... just had a core aspect in sort of the legacy that was Spider-Man, but again, they didn't like that for whatever reason that never made sense, because it's not like, you know, Joe Quesada wanted to end because Greg Wiseman eventually planned to have Mary Jane and Peter Parker get together somewhere down the line. No, that would never happen. That's my jab of the night. I promise there will be no more jabs at Marvel Editorial until the next podcast. But that's a whole different story. again, not embracing the sort of serious sort of legacy aspect within animation that Spectacular Spider-Man was doing extremely well, seeing animation as just a way sort of to pull in sort of the more kid aspect of it, you know, which is why they really like their Ultimate Spider-Man show. And I think it shows here, again, because the story's just a mixture of Marvel, and it's something that Marvel does in their entertainment properties is that they do a lot of mixing and matching of how the continuity has changed over the years. Where, again, because DC is this legacy-based universe, it has that sort of same consistency to the origin and to the story, especially the core stories. You know, it allows, lends itself to the easier way to do it in animation, where you have all these different sort of eras of the origin and everything from Marvel, and you have them trying to condense it and mix and match it for these different shows. And while I think, again, it goes to the difference to why does DC do better in live action, it's hard to do legacy in live action, whereas in because of sort of the more modern mythology aspect of Marvel. And the fact that, you know, again, it allows you to change and sort of blend the origin for a more live-action crowd, that has allowed it to work, as opposed to where, because they're not fully embracing animation, and all the different changes to it, you know, DC has been allowed to, you know, do better with animation, because again, legacy does, I think, better in animation. So it's just something that this movie really highlighted to me, was really the sort of core differences here between Marvel and DC as far as their work on animated properties. So with that, it comes down to final review time for The Invincible Iron Man. You know, as I said before, it's one of those things to where there's nothing... Well, there's tons of things wrong, but it's... I don't feel like they set out to do a bad movie or to half-ass their way or do anything. But at the end of the day, the thing that really hurts this movie is just the lack of passion. And it affects the characters. It affects the animation. The very sort of substandard, sort of middle-of-the-road music. The animation that feels like it should be on television. It's just, there's no passion. Again, there's a reason it's the key word for this episode. Because at the end of the day, the thing that hurts this film is just that they left the passion out of sort of bringing love for a character. And it's just a really different take on the character that, especially after watching the movies, really doesn't appeal to me. And I think anybody would have a hard time appealing to, you know, the Invincible Iron Man, especially when the movies out there have done a more true or more faithful to the origin story of Iron Man. So at the end of the day, the Invincible Iron Man gets 2 out of 5 stars from me. So that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. If you have any comments on the review tonight or anything else about the site, the show, or anything else, remember there are several ways you can contact me. One, you can always email at absolution132@yahoo.com. That's absolution132@yahoo.com. You can also find us on Facebook by going to Facebook and searching for The Absolution Network. Like us and leave us a comment there. And you can always leave us a comment on the site, which you can find at www.an.132productions.com. Also, remember to check out all other 132 production content, which of course includes the Attack of Momentum, right here on the Absolution Network site. Shaft Plus, which is back, starring Gene and Chris, talking about anime again. You can find that at www.shaftplus.com. You can also find the Random Redbox Reviews done by Chris. You can find that at www.randomredboxreviews.com. And then, of course, my other podcasts, which include the Tokyo SOS Podcast. You can find that at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. And, of course, my Comic Book Crazy Podcast, which you can find at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com, which, of course, features my Comic Book Crazy Podcast and Hexcast, the only podcast dedicated to reviewing every issue of Jim Valiant's Tarot, Witch of the Black Rose. And of course, on the sidebar of the site is our friends, which I highly suggest you go check out. This, of course, includes Michael Bailey's Views from the Long Box, and From Crisis to Crisis that he does with Jeffrey Taylor, Brad Douglas's Spider-Man Crawlplace, Steven Schleicher's Major Spoilers Podcast, and of course, Scott Gardner's 2 True Freaks, along with many more that you can find on the sidebar of the site. So that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative as we close out Superhero Month on a bit of a sour note. I really don't like that, so we're going to have to do something fun for next week. And what could be more fun than one of the best animes of 2010? To come out of Japan, or an anime that was done in 2010 in Japan. I am talking about an anime that, well, one, it's a harem, and it's an ecchi anime, so it's definitely right down my, I love this genre style. But this is a harem ecchi anime that really did something different as regards to its art. Because the primary thing that makes this animation great is its art. I am, of course, talking about Hayaka Ryaran Samurai Girls. The series whose second entry of the series, Samurai Bride, is out right now on Crunchyroll.com, streaming every Friday night, and I've been loving that too. So, next week, Samurai Girls. So, until next time, my Toonami generation, stay golden.
Hope you enjoyed it. This is Tom signing off. And until we meet again, you know the rest.